Lufthansa, the German airline, says it's cutting 20,000 flights. And the reason? The price of jet fuel has doubled because of the Iran war, which, despite 2 months of hostilities and a dozen declarations of victory, is still going on. Those cancellations are a straw in the wind, and the most recent assessment from the International Monetary Fund was pretty gloomy. So how bad can things get for the world economy? And even if the war ends soon, what lasting damage has already been done? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by the Nobel Memorial Prize-winning American economist Joseph Stiglitz, who's a professor at Columbia University, and in the studio, the author and economist Duncan Weldon and Diana Scheulever, economist and founder of Enodo Economics. Duncan Weldon, we talked about this on this programme when the war had just begun. Now, can you bring us up to date on what the global economy is looking like now, almost 2 months since the start of this war? And let's begin with oil.
Well, the Strait of Hormuz, which we spoke a lot about when this war first started, you know, the big thing worrying for the global economy was the Strait was closed. Here we are almost 2 months later, and the Strait is still effectively closed. And that's the really big worry for the global economy, because in normal times, 20% of the world's crude and refined products, a lot of it's liquefied natural gas, all sorts of fertilizers, all sorts of other products flow through that Strait. The Strait is closed. So what we've seen is a large spike in energy prices, the price of oil, the price of our other refined products. The price of oil has come down a little bit over the last couple of weeks, but you know, we're now talking about oil at something like $95, $100 a barrel. Before the war, we were talking about $65 a barrel. So this big move in energy prices means we're going to get more inflation and weaker economic growth.
Have we been able at all, has the world been able at all to substitute for the loss of the Strait of Hormuz?
So there has been some substitution within the region. So, for example, Saudi Arabia is moving more oil via an east-west pipeline and exporting it via the Red Sea. The United Arab Emirates has managed to reroute some of its exports to a port which does not face onto the Strait of Hormuz. Iraq is moving more oil via Turkey, some of it by truck. But it looks like, you know, people's numbers slightly vary, but it looks like the world is missing something like 10 to 12 million barrels a day. Global oil demand is about 100 million barrels per day. This is a big number.
And as of now, who's being affected worst?
The countries whose economies are being hit the hardest are Iran and the Gulf countries, who have been directly involved in one way or another in the fighting. We step out back from that. We look at the global energy price shock. It's roughly what you'd expect. Countries which export oil or export energy are better placed to weather this sort of shock. Your Canada's, your Norway's. It's a very mixed picture in the United States, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in detail. The countries that are the hardest hit are countries which import a lot of energy and have a relatively low income.
The Lufthansa thing seems to suggest that actually we're already on the cusp of certain sorts of shortages, which we're going to feel as travellers and consumers.
Yes, so lots of the attention, particularly in Europe, has been on price changes. Alongside price changes, we have to worry about quantities. And you've already seen shortages of lots of refined products across parts of Asia who feel this shock quicker because it takes a tanker less time to get from, you know, the Gulf of Oman into Asia. Those sorts of shortages now start to become worrying in Europe. You know, Europe has received its last shipment of jet fuel from the region. It came at the start of April. It's not just Lufthansa cutting flights. Lots of European airlines are not just worried about the cost of jet fuel. They're worried there is not going to be enough jet fuel available for all of their planned flights.
Right. So that just can't be dealt with simply by surcharging passengers on flights. It's going to mean fewer flights. And finally, Duncan, before I move on to Joe Stiglitz, this isn't the first economic shock of the 2020s. So just remind us briefly of the others, this kind of builds up.
Briefly, obviously in 2020, we had the pandemic, lockdowns, disruptions of global supply chains. 2022, we had Russia invading Ukraine, an energy price and food price shock. 2025, we had the United States and President Trump going for sort of the largest increase in tariffs of any advanced economy in about a century and really volatile trading environment. The interesting thing is, I think, in the 2050s, in the 2060s, when economic historians write about the 2020s, they will say what marked the 2020s was all of these major shocks coming so close together, because, you know, 6 years feels like an age to live through, but it's a blink of the eye in terms of the grand sweep of economic history.
Joe Stiglitz, how serious do you consider the world economic situation to be as of right now?
I think it's serious, but how serious will really depend on how things unfold. Let me pick up on one thing that Duncan said. Since World War II, we've been working to create a borderless world, a rules-based international trade system. We told countries, you don't need to be self-reliant on food. We have a global economy where you can take advantage of comparative advantage and economies of specialization. The events that Duncan just described have meant we've moved away from that in a dramatic way. And whatever happens in the future has meant that countries are going to become more self-reliant. The second thing that is clearly here right now is we had not brought inflation down from the levels of the post-pandemic to what central banks had considered acceptable, 2%. And now we have an inflationary shock, which the IMF anticipates will put inflation well above 3%. That means higher interest rates, slower economic growth, more economic disruption. And finally, to pick up on who is affected the most, one group that is very badly affected are the highly indebted countries, the poor countries in Africa and elsewhere. The shocks that we described before, the pandemic, the oil price shock associated with Ukraine, the general increase in interest rates, has all had a devastating effect, putting many of these countries into debt distress. This will put some of those countries over the top. And finally, I did want to comment, while the United States is a net exporter of oil, not a lot, but you would have thought we would not be much affected. But the fact is, a country like the United States is integrated into the global market. And that means the price of oil and gasoline has gone up. And there's a massive redistribution from ordinary consumers, the producers of ordinary commodities, to the oil and gas companies. And that is very disruptive. If the consumers are not happy, producers are not happy about their goods. So it is very disruptive, even in countries that are in the aggregate not affected. The distribution effects are enormous.
Joe, can we do an act of comparison here? I mean, you've looked at the history of such shocks going, and oil shocks including, going right the way back. How does this compare with, I don't know, say the oil shocks of the 1970s and the economic consequences of that?
In one sense, the relative magnitude of the increase in price today is smaller. But as, again, Duncan mentioned, the world has become more dependent on fertilizer, natural gas, going through the Straits of Hormuz. So the range of effects is likely to be greater. People are talking about consequences in agriculture that was not part of the scenario back in the 70s. There are some elements in common. The inflationary shock in the 70s was very bad. Given the history that we've had, that we've been talking about, that makes this particularly difficult.
Joe, are you talking about a scenario in which you will have lower economic growth but still high inflation, which of course is a situation that has a specific word coined for it?
Yeah, stagflation. And I think there is a risk of stagflation. It will affect different countries differently, and it will depend a little bit on how monetary policy reacts. Normally, monetary policy reacts to inflation by increasing interest rates, and that further slows down the economy on top of the shock. President Trump is trying to end the independence of the Federal Reserve and have low interest rates in spite of the inflationary shock. I don't think he's going to get away with it.
I mean, you're a better reader, of course, of the American scene than I am. But my distinct impression was that the American consumer was not a great fan of inflation.
Oh, no country is a great fan of inflation. And even before this war, a central issue in the American discourse was what we call the affordability crisis. Our mayor here in New York, Mondami, ran on the platform of affordability and got enormous support. So many Americans are feeling the crunch. It's partly because we've had this enormous growth of inequality in our country. So it's a combination of this trend in America of greater and greater inequality with the inflation really making people feel life is really hard.
And Joe, what about the economic impact of tariffs? It's a year on, isn't it, from that famous Liberation Day with those great charts showing that Cambodia would have to pay 73% more tariffs or something like that. What is understood to be the economic impact of those tariffs in addition to what we're doing now?
Well, it's added an enormous amount of uncertainty. The threats is going up, going down, going up, going down. Supreme Court ruling that the tariffs were illegal, his imposing a new set of tariffs. The inflationary effects have been smaller. The reason is the tariffs have not been actually imposed. So the estimate of the average tariff increase is a little bit more than 10%. Now, we just don't know where he's going to go from here. And his threats have been such that there continues to be a lot of uncertainty. Only two countries have really stood up to him, China and Brazil. And he backed down on both cases.
Deanna, a perfect cue into you. China, of course, is the other great main economic powerhouse. As you look at China, how worried has China been about the Iran conflict? What's in it for them?
You know, let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most worried, I would argue 8. And it's both from a economic point of view, despite all the resilience it built in the system, it's still very dependent on oil. And if this conflict continues longer than the weeks we've seen and moves into months, then China's industrial processes will be threatened, much less the inflationary impact. That worries them less at this stage because unusually they actually are coming up from deflationary pressures. So that's in a way not too bad. But the real big change here is the geopolitical dimension. And you mentioned the tariffs impact. What has happened is that we're living in a bifurcating world, splitting between a US and a Chinese sphere of influence. When the US played the tariff card, China responded with restricting access to critical minerals. And that turned out to be a very strong card that the US was not prepared for China using.
Right, so the inflation isn't such a problem, but the oil is a problem. Can you tell us what the knock-on problems inside the Chinese economy are as a consequence of that?
The uses of oil, it's two ways. There is fuel and then there is the petrochemical side of things. In terms of fuel, China has diversified not just from the perspective of where it gets its oil from, but also towards renewable energy. However, when it comes to the petrochemicals, and yes, they do have a lot of refining capacity domestically, they don't have to import petrochemicals, they refine at home, but you still need the raw oil to do so. And then that has a knock-on impact on the various industrial processes, on plastics, on fertilizer, as you mentioned, food. The second aspect of all this is that the other countries that have been the most affected are the likes of Japan, India, Korea, and certainly China now is dealing a lot more in terms of its trade and growth with Asia than the rest of the world. So the second knock-on impact is what happens to the rest of the world and how their demand shock will impact China.
Now, before I bring Joe and Duncan in on this, can you just tell us what role, therefore, China's been playing in trying to end this war if the stakes are quite high for it?
So China brought Iran to the table. in terms of these negotiations, because for starters, their perception of this particular Iranian regime is not a good one. Also, it hasn't made the situation inside Iran for its people good. So the Chinese are not looking favorably from that perspective on this Iranian regime. And the final straw, I would say, that sort of breaks the camel's back is the fact that in the West, we're very used to rooting for the underdog. In China, that's not the case. It's the exact opposite. And so looking at how successful America has been with its military operation, the strategic discussion is separate, they are not happy with that. So they want a resolution now, but it is this triangular negotiation vis-a-vis their relationship with the US and importantly with the Gulf countries. So China is constrained because so much of its oil comes from the Gulf countries that it cannot support Iran 100%.
Joe, before I go to Duncan and get all parochial and ask him about the effect on us here in the UK, what's the perception in the US amongst, if you like, the sort of more savvy commentators about where this current situation leaves relations between and the power relations between the US and China?
Well, first, let me say, put this in broader context. China has prospered on the basis of a rules-based global order. They've been able to export. And so this disruption that began with Trump tariffs and now Trump invasion of Iran is very counter to what has brought them prosperity over the last 25 years. It's also changed their view of themselves and the world view of them as the stable element of the global order. They've become the advocate of the rules-based order, not the United States. A real change. And so countries elsewhere in the world say, China is a reliable ally. The U.S. is not a reliable ally. That is a very big change in the geopolitical order. And I think, you know, looking forward, that will have big consequences. But right now, what China's main strategy, I think, is to restore some kind of order to the world. And I agree with what Diana just said. They're unhappy with what has been going on, and they would like greater stability to the world.
Right. So that puts a big emphasis upon them. They're likely to make major efforts to try and get some kind of a settlement. We can bank that one. Duncan, let's talk about the UK. How is the UK economy weathering the war in Iran?
Well, it's early days, but the signs aren't very good. The International Monetary Fund, when it published its new global economic forecasts at its spring meetings, it gave the UK the biggest downgrade of any advanced economy.
Why?
That's because the UK is very exposed to international gas prices. We're an energy importer. The structure of our domestic energy markets means that movements in the price of gas have a really big impact on the price of electricity and fuel for households and for firms. You know, there's been a big disruption in gas markets. So Qatar obviously hasn't been able to export any of its liquefied natural gas. In fact, its primary export facility has been damaged. They say capacity is going to be down by 17% for 3 to 5 years it will take to reply. So what the IMF was saying is you're going to see quite a large spike in inflation in the United Kingdom this year. And that's changed the outlook for the Bank of England. We were expecting the Bank of England to cut interest rates this year. And now people are talking about how many hikes there will be.
So the drop in the expectation of economic growth is a function of the increased interest rates, which will be a function of the rise in inflation, which will be a function of the increase in oil prices, which we can't offset.
Yeah, it's all a self-reinforcing mess from the point of view of the UK. But it's worth saying we're in a very different situation to where we were in February. In February, it looked like inflation was finally heading back towards the Bank of England's 2% target. You know, investors were expecting maybe 2 cuts in the Bank of England's interest rate this year. There were signs that consumer confidence was starting to climb again. And then you get into that virtuous circle of people feeling a bit more confident, spending a bit more money, that leading to more confidence. Now, we've got inflation heading up. We've got interest rates definitely not being cut, possibly being hiked. And the latest figures from Ipsos Mori show UK consumer confidence at the lowest since they started collecting the numbers in 1978.
Right, OK. Let's look at the future scenarios, if we can, because there are different scenarios. And Joe, you hinted at them earlier. There is the scenario that says this ends soon. So take me through what the best scenario would be and what the consequences of it would be, starting from where we are now.
Well, if it ends soon, then, of course, the magnitude of the increase in oil prices, food prices, will be limited. But let me emphasize that they still would be there. It was just mentioned. There's been destruction of the infrastructure in the Middle East. So the idea that things would just go back to normal, I think, is a fantasy. The prices will be higher than they would have been had there not been this reckless war Donald Trump has waged. So that would be the best scenario, but we'll still have economic and therefore political consequences and all the things we've talked about, interest rates, stagflation.
So that's based on the Strait of Hormuz opening tomorrow. Those things would all still be the case.
That's right. But if the war continues, what is going to happen is obviously much worse. It is likely if a U.S. bombs Iran, Iran will take aggressive actions to destroy more infrastructure in the Middle East, causing a greater long-term damage to the possibilities of restoration of the oil. It takes years and years. And the immediate effect on prices of oil and food will be that much greater. And the follow-on effect on interest rates, consumer confidence, the shortages that you mentioned in the very beginning, all of those will get much, much worse.
Deanna, let's imagine that the Strait gets opened within the next week and people say, well, actually, we've had enough war now, that's it. Looking at it from the point of view of China, what do you think the consequence would be? Would they get back to normal quickly or would it take some time?
Look, in my job as a forecaster, I am often really trying to figure out what is the most likely scenario. And that most likely scenario doesn't look that good. It is not just opening the Strait of Hormuz, it's how you open the Strait of Hormuz. Is that as a result of sort of the Iranian regime collapsing, there appearing to be kind of a benign actor that gets it together and sides with the US and China and the US reach some sort of modus vivendi that's more stable in critical minerals for oil type of deal, which I would say is probably the best possible scenario? Is this going to be an Iranian regime that hangs on to power, is in its last legs, but doesn't have as much capability to resist? In which case, you open the Strait of Hormuz, but the most likely scenario is that this will have to be policed, so no, it's not a return to normal.
Duncan, we're sticking for the moment with the idea that we might actually see an end to this war soon, i.e. the better case scenario. Even given that, how long does it take to defray the damage that's already done in terms of the world economy, in terms of the tendency towards inflation, high prices, blow to economic growth and so on?
We've got two different issues here. We've got actual damage to physical infrastructure, you know, hits to upstream and downstream oil and gas producing capacity, whether that's, you know, the refineries that have been hit and the export terminals that have been hit in Qatar. We don't know the full extent of that damage yet. But even if that damage was minimal, even if the Strait was to reopen tomorrow, it would take an awful long time to sort this out. Lots of oil production in the Middle East around the Gulf has been turned off because they've run out of storage capacity. And these aren't like light switches you can flick on and off. It takes several weeks, sometimes longer, to get, you know, production back into the same place. Lots of the tankers are now in the wrong part of the world because the Strait has been closed and they've gone to, you know, export oil from the United States or something else. And tankers, as we've learned throughout this crisis, move quite slowly. Even if the Strait was to reopen tomorrow, you would be talking months before the flow of oil and gas from the Strait was back up towards pre-war levels, even leaving aside the damage. I think, you know, the good scenario was that this war lasted a few days. That's gone now. Now, whatever happens in a bad world where we've got disruption and higher energy prices for at least the rest of this year, probably into next. And there is a very real ugly scenario that the strait stays closed for weeks longer. And the supplies and stockpiles we've been running down to get through these interrupted flows are exhausted.
Joe, this brings us back to the scenarios which are worse. The strait does remain closed for some time. Can you take us through what I, as a citizen, would see in 2, 3, 4, 5 years' time?
It is going to motivate a restructuring the global economy. Some of that is already going on. Countries that were greener, that have moved to renewable, are not as dependent on fossil fuel. And so that will accelerate that kind of green transition. I think that's a good thing. On the other hand, it has illustrated once again the fact that we global supply chains are not resilient. Take fertilizer. And that is going to, I hope, motivate an effort to decentralize, to diversify. But that will be costly, and that will take time. So what I would anticipate is this is going to motivate a restructuring of the global economy along lines that were already beginning to go on because of Trump's tariffs, because of the supply chain interruptions, the pandemic, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So this is going to motivate a major change in the global economic order. The role of China versus the rest of the world is going to change. I think China was playing by the rules as they were written down. In fact, China was just more successful. And we have to admit that they used the size of the market, their planning capacity, and the number of engineers, their investment in innovation, totally different from what is happening in the United States, where we are going in the opposite direction. So we're going to emerge from this whole episode with China, I think, much stronger, and the United States weakened, no matter what happens.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Joseph Stiglitz, Diana Scheuleva, and Duncan Weldon. And just before we go, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the recent one which asks whether the triple lock pension guarantee can last, and the one which looks at the state of the UK's armed forces. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirsty Knight and Sally Abrahams. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill. The editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, I'm Johnny Diamond and I'm the presenter of the Radio 4 series How Did We Get Here? Israel and the Palestinians. We explore the complicated backstory of that Middle East conflict as the region endures another wider war. Through conversations with experts with a variety of perspectives, we travel back through the centuries to examine the history of the land that's now so contested between Arabs and Israelis, and we try and understand the past that's brought us to such a present. How did we get here? Israel and the Palestinians. Listen on BBC Sounds.